thank your God, Brandon? Is that what you thought when you choked the life out of him? Is that what you thought when you served food from his grave? Well, I don't know what you thought or what you are, but I know what you've done. You've murdered Brandon. You've choked the life out of a fellow human being who could live and love as you never could, and never will again. It's not what I'm gonna do, Brandon. It's what society's gonna do. I don't know what that's gonna be, but I can guess, and I can help. You're gonna die, Brandon. Both of you. You're gonna die. Hello, and welcome to Ribbon of Memes, episode 151, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other masters of suspense as masterpieces. I am Nick, the weird stranger with a mischievous plan that you may find on a train, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
Don't ask what's in the box. It's all fine.
And we are, after a brief diversion into Shakespeare, we are once again discussing the master of suspense himself, Mr. Alfred Hitchcock, with another duo of murderous tales. Now, that lengthy quote from the beginning, I should mention that is from Rope, the 1948 film, which we'll be discussing second. But I, for some reason, I learned that as a party trick to show off. As a student, incredibly, didn't get me laid as much as you might think it was.
Man, I should have gone to those sort of parties.
but it did surprise people with the intensity of my performance. I've no idea why I learned that particular section, but I did, and I can still remember it now. But we will come on to Rope, because actually we're going to discuss Strangers on a Train, the 1951... black and white film. Now I have a feeling this was this based? It's based on a short story, isn't it?
Patricia Highsmith novel.
Right, yes.
I think of the same title. I'll come back to that because the plot diverges quite a bit.
Yes. In fact, most of Hitchcock's work was based on other stories, as I think about it. In fact, most of the ones we have covered, maybe not North by Northwest, but this one was. And it is the story of, well, two strangers on a train who meet and agree, inverted commas, to swap murders. The idea being that if you have two murders and people with no motive at all to commit the murder and the other person with a rock-solid alibi and you kind of swap your murders over, then it's foolproof. It's the perfect crime. I suspect Roger's perfect crime corner might crop up a few times.
Well, I mean, it may help in some respects. The thing is, I find this very interesting because people talk about Strangers on a Train as a cultural shorthand when they mean just that, you know, I do your murder, you do mine.
Yeah.
But at least as it's shown here, that one of the people involved has no intention of doing it. This weird guy has come up to him and made the suggestion, and he says quite unambiguously, no. Yes. Not going to do it. This is crazy talk.
Farley Granger, as Guy, who is a tennis champion, is recognised by Bruno, a kind of creepy character played by Robert Walker.
We'd see all we need to know about him in the very first shot. Those shoes.
The film opens up with it. They're kind of showy. Well, it's how do you describe those?
They would be described quite specifically, at least in the UK, as a correspondent shoes, as in the man who is going to be named in a divorce suit.
okay,
they had that kind of reputation.
He is sort of showy and flamboyant, not necessarily what you want in a murderer. But yes, he wants to get rid of his father, and sort of having read like the equivalent of Hello Magazine, has decided that Guy wants to get rid of his wife. Not necessarily incorrectly, but Guy has no intention of murdering her. He's going through a messy divorce.
Yeah, Guy is a tennis pro with political ambitions, which may have been plausible in 1951. I don't know,
Sebastian Coe was not a tennis coach, but he did all right.
He is in the process of disentangling himself from his marriage in order to, as everybody knows, marry the senator's daughter.
Yes. And to make this nicely uncomplicated, the wife is portrayed as an absolutely horrendous, vindictive harlot, whereas the woman he's leaving for is saintly and pure. Things are not necessarily as simple as that, of course, but it aids the plot for that reason. Whereas Bruno is the son of a millionaire who hates him and thinks he's a lazy idiot. And the easiest way of helping his father to help him is to help his father into an early grave so he can inherit all the money. And Bruno pretty quickly suggests this to Guy, who reacts as most reasonable people would, with like, are you kidding me? What are you talking about? But Bruno seems to take this as kind of an ascent that he wants to go on with. The fact that...
Well, the way I see it, Bruno has pretty much written out how this conversation goes in his head. And when it diverges from that, he's not really paying attention.
No, but it leads to the rather big flaw that surely the whole point of this is to have a rock-solid alibi for you when the person that you want to get murdered is killed by someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But because Guy doesn't know this, he's got a fairly weak alibi, and he doesn't actually want his wife murdered anyway. So Bruno's fallen off the first hurdle here.
He's shown us obviously coming a bit close to it at times, and she is determined to ruin his life.
Yeah, she's quite
vindictive. But he is a good guy, so he's not going to do that, even if he does shout in a public place down a phone, I could kill her.
Again...
Roger's Murder Corner, don't do this.
Yes, I thought Roger's Murder Corner would crop up a bit. Anyway, Bruno being the strange character that he is. So these are... I'm not sure we've had either of these actors on Ribbon of Muse before. Farley Granger and Robert Walker. I think they're both very good here. I mean, Robert Walker is suitably creepy and weird and very believable as someone you would do your very best to avoid on a train as much as possible.
Yeah, also for me has a bit of a touch of the young Robert Vaughn.
Oh, yes, yeah, I would go along with that. Farley Granger is... Well, he's... I don't know if he's supposed to... I think in the book... He is a bit more black and white, a bit more grey, shades of grey. Here he's kind of, although he has his moments of temper, there's never really any tension or suggestion that he is going to sort of do the murder back. Because he's too good, you know, he's clearly not going to go and kill Bruno's dad. Now we are kind of...
And that is the primary change, in fact, because in the book he does.
Yes. Okay, so I gather that he does go and actually commit his reverse murder. So the way the plot develops is that Bruno, not really taking no for an answer, does he contact... I think he contacts Guy a couple more times, but pretty...
He basically says, I've done your murder, now you can do mine. Because we agreed.
I'd like to talk about the first murder, the murder of Guy's wife, because so this is on a in New York on what's its face Coney Island.
I don't know if
it's explicitly said, but it's somewhere like that regardless. Is it Barbara that gets murdered? No, Barbara's Miriam. His girlfriend Miriam. The shock, she's going out with two boys at once at the same time in the, so she's clearly asking for it. I don't think she gets a very sympathetic look in. I know Hitchcock was legendarily caring of women and nurturing of them, but I feel like he doesn't treat Miriam necessarily very well here.
I mean, she has a story. She's not a good person, but she is presented as, I agreed to the divorce, but now that you've turned up to do it, I'm just going to say no, not going to do it after all. Also, yep. I'm pregnant, brackets not yours, brackets I'm going to tell everybody it's yours. And so on.
Because our sympathies really need to be with Guy at this point. The murder itself is really interestingly, everyone talks about the psycho murder, but in this one, so he He tracks her down. He goes on this tunnel of love / rowboat adventure over to a secluded island.
Yeah, it's a very nice kind of fake out because you think, oh, obviously it's going to happen in the tunnel, and then it doesn't.
And then on the island itself, he just flat out strangles her to death. And the way it's framed, so we see this, her glasses fall on the floor, and then we see the murder reflected in her glass. I think that's a really cool, I know Hitchcock's more about the technical stuff, but I think here it is a really cool technical shot. Apparently it was an absolute bugger to shoot, I think. but it's really well done, I thought. I really like that kind of, from an artistic point of view, it's impressive to watch.
Yeah, from a technical point of view, and this really is Roger's Murder Corner, it takes a lot longer to strangle someone than that. And you do it that long, unless you're breaking bones, which probably you should be, but you strangle them a bit like that, they are probably going to recover in 5 or 10 minutes, and there may be a bit of oxygen deprivation damage, but basically they're probably still going to be alive.
Hmm.
As somebody once put it, you're not through until he's blue.
Well, I mean, strangling, what you're really doing is closing off the carotid arteries, and because humans weirdly don't have a reti system which goes up their spinal column, then this is a way to get rid of humans as opposed to cows and things.
And don't try strangling a cow. It's not likely to end well.
It won't work, yeah. pro tip. Okay.
Yeah, but also there is a particular nerve cluster that you can hit that actually shuts the heart down, but that takes technical competence and knowledge of anatomy and things, so.
Bruno doesn't seem to, he's very enthusiastic, but, and he knows what he's doing, with his hand, but yeah, it's a very kind of clean murder. We've talked about kind of my feelings of murder mysteries and things before. It is, to me, it's one of those that makes it all look kind of easy and not messy and quite, I'm not a fan of making murder look as easy and clean as it is shown here.
I do think that Psycho, which we talked about recently, does many of the same things and deliberately does them more grittily, more unpleasantly.
Yes,
effect.
I think what I liked about Psycho, we commented at the time, was that Anthony Perkins gives the very strong impression this is not the first time he has dealt with this sort of situation. Hmm. Whereas Bruno, we're not really sure. I mean, I think Bruno is probably a psychopath in the, you know, the medical sense of the word. He doesn't possibly, and I didn't want to get too armchair psychologist about it, but he doesn't seem to have any qualms about behaving in a way that gives him maximum profit in whatever it does to anyone else.
Yeah, I mean, we are not going to come in and be that guy at the end of Psycho. So, this is a fictional depiction, and he does what it needs to do. I don't think it's particularly consistent with any specific mental illness, though. It's not impossible that someone could do that, obviously.
Yes, fair point. Anyway, he does the murder, and then, yeah, as you say, rings Guy up and eventually meets Guy in desperation because, right, I've done mine. Are you going to go and do yours now? My dad needs killing. We had a deal.
And Guy, the thing I think is probably the weakest part of the film is that Guy could simply go to the police straight away.
Mm.
And he doesn't. And there's a bit of an argument from
Bruno, the father of
from Bruno as to why he shouldn't. But frankly, I didn't find it very much of an argument.
the MacGuffin in this film is the lighter that that Guy left on the table in the train journey. That is going to prove that he was at the scene of the crime. That's going to prove that Bruno is going to take along to the scene of the crime and drop it there to prove that Guy was there at the murder of his wife. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't do that in the first place. And there really is, aside from the motive, that there really is very little tying Guy to this thing. And I agree that it's pretty tenuous. But he also gets, as soon as the murder happens, everyone around Guy is like, they're going to suspect you. But clearly the best thing to do, I would have thought, yeah, I agree, would be to just go and explain and say I've got an alibi as best I can.
Yeah, as it turns out, it's not much of an alibi because the other guy in the compartment of the train he was in was very, very drunk and remembers nothing.
But presumably he's got a train ticket and, you know, more evidence. But so Guy is then followed by a policeman because he does come under suspicion, funnily enough. But he doesn't mention Bruno at all, and he doesn't mention the conversation on the train. And things progress to the point where the story gets a bit derailed for me because it starts to creep into this has got to happen for plot reasons, really. Because, well, first of all, Guy goes to visit the father in the middle of the night with a gun, the person that he's supposed to kill.
Giving Bruno the idea that he is actually going to do it.
Yes.
So he's saying.
But actually what he's going to do is sneak into the house in the middle of the night, wake up the father and then say, your son killed my wife and he wants me to kill you. Which, again, this is entirely for... If you're going to do that, just ring him up or go in the day. You don't sneak into the house in the middle of the night with a gun. It just seems odd to me why he would do that, other than for the suspense of, oh, he's going to do the murder. Oh, no, he isn't. No, okay.
And as it turns out, it's Bruno there anyway.
Mm. Yes, Bruno is in the bed, being suspicious that Guy's not the stiff-upper-lipped murderer he hoped he was.
I do get a strong feeling of things that would work, frankly, better in North by Northwest. The whole, you know, everybody's against you. You got to run, you got to hide.
Yeah.
You are just a normal person, you're not equipped for this.
Well, that is a recurring Hitchcock theme, the kind of the wrong man and the everyman accused of something, a crime he didn't commit or hasn't committed yet.
I think a lot of this was also, particularly this one, influenced by the whole Red Scare, House on American Activities Committee, that kind of thing.
Right,
you know,
yes.
All of a sudden, all your friends are turning away from you because they don't want to get taken down with you.
Yeah, and I suppose a lack of trust in the authorities.
Within what was possible with the code, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, it's not... All the G-men here, the police and the government agents are actually on the level and they're not trying to frame anyone or not too lazy to do their job. But regardless, Guy doesn't trust them. And then we sort of move into this sequence of... it just seems odd to me. Like, we're going to have a tennis match, and for reasons of plot, I've got to win this match in three sets. So that's a way of adding a lot of tension to a random tennis match in the middle of the film or towards the end of the film. How did that work?
At least that's not Jesus Franco who would have a random scene set in a strip club. He did this in most of his films.
Fair point. Okay. But it just felt to me such a contrivance of, he's a tennis player. He's going to play some tennis, but we don't just want a boring tennis match. So now we've got to make it a super high stakes tennis match. It didn't work for me because I just felt, I don't know. It just didn't quite grab me.
I'm reminded of the character in an Infinite Worlds campaign I ran who specifically got cricket sporting skill.
Right.
And I kept trying to work out ways for bad guys to be throwing grenades and things for him to use his cricket skills. It never quite worked out.
Well, this is a subject for another podcast, but Trail of Cthulhu would have sorted that all out.
Yeah, you get plus two.
Right.
Anyway.
So... Then, again, it's a little contrived, but then Bruno, on the strength of, you're not going to kill my dad, are you? Well, if you don't, I'm going to take this lighter that I have got from you, and I'm going to drop it where I did the murder before, so that when the police look again, they'll find your lighter and think, oh, he must have been there. Yeah, it all seems a bit contrived to me, because now it's much harder to get... on the island because there's been a murder there.
I mean, one could argue that to some extent this is Bruno's fantasy of how it will work and it doesn't actually need to work, but in order for the tension to happen, we need to believe that it could work.
That's it, yeah. It's all getting to a point of, oh, it's going to... maybe it's sort of, as we've talked about the concept of fridge logic, that it just, it doesn't survive the trip to the fridge before you start getting, hang on, why? And if it doesn't, then the tension that it creates and the suspense that it builds up are dissipated. I feel like I'm being a little down. I mean, there's a lot to like about the film, but I felt the plot got increasingly convoluted from the moment that Guy goes to almost do the murder, his murder.
The impression I got, and I haven't read the book, I should say, so I don't know to what extent any of these scenes may be taken from it or inspired by it, but it felt as if that somebody had said, you've got to have this scene, and then there's some frantic paste-up work to make that scene fit into the story at this point.
It feels like tennis match, yep. Go back to the scene of the murder, yep. Let's have a crazy carousel.
I mean, great trigger discipline. There is a rapidly spinning roundabout full of children. Let's open fire.
Exactly. So, to explain, if you haven't seen the film, it ends up that both Guy and Bruno are on a carousel with the police closing in. And one of the police just... And this poor guy, the carousel operator, the police just open up and the carousel operator dies leaning on the go super fast lever for the carousel, which starts going super fast.
Yeah,
poor guy who gets killed never gets mentioned again.
We really ought to see the children being flung off in all directions.
But the carousel becomes a death trap leads to, I mean, it is quite a cool scene, which apparently was actually, you know, there's no special effects here. He was crawling, the old carousel operator was crawling under a very fast, probably sped up, but still very fast moving carousel and could have been seriously hurt and wasn't. But then he fails miserably because then he gets to the carousel and he pulls the brake on so quickly that the carousel breaks and shatters. And collapses onto Bruno, who attempts with his last words to still frame Guy, basically. But he frames Guy and says, you shouldn't have killed your wife, regard. But then they search his body and they find the lighter. And this is enough to immediately clear Guy of any suspicion whatsoever.
Even though if Guy had had it on him, he could have planted it on Bruno before anybody else got there.
Yeah, exactly. It just doesn't... it beggars logic to me. The whole last thing, it just feels like such, this must happen because plot. So yeah. I think for the last half of the film, I was not as engaged, is my honest feeling. It just didn't... it didn't create suspense to me because I was starting to feel, that's just ridiculous. I love the premise of the film.
The initial setup works very well. Bruno is, you know, he seems at first he's just a fellow passenger. Okay, he's an annoyingly chatty fellow passenger. Okay, now he's getting a bit weird.
Yes. I think... For me, I like Farley Granger, you know, he's a good actor. I never have felt he was a great actor in things I've seen him in, but he's very good at emotions and facial expressions and, you know, how he's... I think it would have worked better for me if he was a bit of a greyer character, if we were a bit more suspicious of his motives. And we did think, oh, he's going to actually do the murder, but I never really felt that for a second.
I don't know to what extent people going to see the film would have read the book or not, but obviously if you had, you might well be thinking in that direction already.
Because in the book, he does go around and kill the father. So what happens at the end of the book?
He's caught.
Right, okay.
I think they both are, but I haven't read it. Some production notes on this, which I found interesting at least. This was almost written by Raymond Chandler. In fact, it was written by Raymond Chandler, whom we've talked about before with Double Indemnity, The Big Sleep, The Long Goodbye. But Ben Hecht's assistant, Jensi Ormond, rewrote everything after Hex reckoned it was no good, so.
Well, Raymond Chandler and Alfred Hitchcock, it was not a marriage made in heaven, I get that. And so their relationship deteriorated to the point of Chandler very loudly saying, "Look at that fat idiot trying to get out of the car," or something to that effect, as Hitchcock attempted to exit a vehicle. Hitchcock not having a great sense of humour about his weight or appearance. So I think they tried to... Does the screenplay actually mention Chandler at all? I don't think it does.
No, he doesn't get credit in the end.
Yeah, well, it was not a marriage of... of any kind.
Oh no! Apparently he does, but his work is all has all been removed
and written over. Okay,
yeah, because the Writers Guild system, you know, if they didn't actually start from a complete clean slate, he has to get credit. I think or less how it works. But I gather that the actual work, what you're getting, is Ormond.
Yeah, I that's the impression I got from looking over the story itself. It's extremely competently made. I love a black and white film.
It's doing a lot of use of the black and white. To me, not quite to the point of overdoing it, though it came close at times, but that whole, yes, we will have the black and white in the scene, starting with those shoes and going on from there.
And it's, there's some really nice moments, like the tennis match where everyone's looking left and right and watching, and then we zoom in on Bruno's face, who's just staring directly at Guy. Mm. It perhaps feels a bit convoluted, but I like it. A lot of those work for me. The murder works for me.
Couple of actors in minor roles. Leo G. Carroll.
Oh, yes. Always nice to see Leo G. Carroll. As the senator, the father of Barbara, who is Guy's...
The good girl.
Haven't said much about...
Oh, no,
her.
I'm sorry, Anne, because it's the younger sister, Barbara, who is played
that's right.
by Patricia Hitchcock, whom we saw briefly in Psycho. This, I think, was her biggest film role. And... gotta say, she's a bit rubbish.
Yeah. She's the kind of nerdy, bookish sister.
But at the same time, a bit tomboy because she's prepared to help out Guy when the rest of the family is thinking, well, you know, maybe we ought to retrench a bit and at least not be seen with him. She's still up for helping.
Yeah. And Anne... she's very forgettable. I mean, you get the impression, really, that Hitchcock, she wasn't blonde, so he wasn't interested, really. Anne is not a Hitchcock blonde, and so the camera doesn't kind of ogle her in the way it would later on with Grace Kelly and Tippi Hedren and all that kind of stuff. She gets very little to do other than be a sort of... not quite a scream queen, but a damsel in distress in some ways. She doesn't really do very much.
Yeah, and so she's on the credits as Laura Elliott. She was known long-term as Casey Rogers, who plays Miriam. If you look up her profile photo on Wikipedia, she looks very much like a Hitchcock blonde, but she isn't here. So...
She's the most interesting female, and really the only one of the female characters that kind of gets a personality, I think. She's a wrong'un, but mm-hmm. She's an interesting character in a way that the other female characters aren't. I did really like Robert Walker as Bruno, who really sells this kind of unpredictable, is he joking? Because he does it all with kind of a smirk and a smug expression. Mm. Now we didn't see much of Robert Walker afterwards because he actually died before the film was released. That's quite a sad story. So he basically was. I don't get in trouble. But his one of his physicians seemed to say, "Oh, he's in a depressive mood. He needs a sedative," and gave him a very strong sedative, which killed him. And there's some suggestion they forced it upon him. But anyway. Robert Walker.
And there was a claim that he'd been drinking, which would obviously have made it worse, and then somebody else claimed that he hadn't been, and yeah.
It's slightly, I mean, accidental death, but very sad. He never saw the release of the film, or the success. Farley Granger, had already been one of Hitchcock's, beaux, if you like, one of Hitchcock's, along with James Stewart, Cary Grant, one of Hitchcock's favourite actors to work with, and we'll talk about him again in a moment.
Cause... Yeah, and of course, another roundabout confrontation we've had on Ribbon of Memes in Shadow of the Thin Man. Though at least there is the excuse of a small child on the roundabout.
Now, I never watched Shadow of the Thin Man, but yes, it reminded you of a situation on a carousel, otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously good for a certain amount of physical danger, something that can't be resolved by simply shooting the bad guy because you can't reliably hit him, and so on. So, yeah.
Perhaps, so for me...
it should be used more.
Well, yeah, we should have more carousel-based action, but we get plenty of it here. For me, from a film from the master of suspense, I'm afraid it didn't fill me with suspense. It had the setup, as you say, was good, but it just felt so convoluted towards the end.
Well, also, there's a thing I tend to feel about a lot of narrative of this kind, particularly of the what's really going on variety. It's much easier to build up complication and say, gosh, what's this? Gosh, what's that? What could this possibly mean? Than it is to explain it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's much easier. Yeah.
And this
anyone
packs,
who watched Lost knows what you're talking about.
Yeah. This packs much of his explanation into right at the end. And then, you know, the occasional interview with his mother who's saying, well, he's a bit weird, but he's a good boy and so on.
Yeah. It doesn't have the psycho bit. I mean, I liked Psycho more, but God, that explanation at the end.
Yeah.
We don't have that.
On the other hand, how did Bruno get to this particular fantasy of the, you know, meeting a stranger and swapping murders? It doesn't seem to be key to his psyche, except that he wants to kill his father. He wants his father dead, but he doesn't have the guts to do it himself. But I don't know.
Yeah, it's. I would go back. It just all. Apologies, I'm pouring a beer while I'm talking, which is not helpful. I would go back to the. It has to happen because the plot has to happen because this has to be suspenseful. It doesn't quite. Yeah, okay. It didn't quite work for me, and I feel like it could have done.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the machinery of suspense works because I'm emotionally involved, because I'm thinking this guy, whom I at least slightly like, is in danger. And
yes.
the more the film reminds me that this is not actual events, this is a film, this has been scripted, the more I'm thrown out of that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's all about suspension of disbelief, isn't it? And once you no longer believe this is happening because of character motivation, you know, you're happy to go away along that route, and we've all got different, you know, areas where we'll believe more and believe less. But this one broke it for me relatively quickly, and therefore I was no longer suspenseful.
Yeah, I mean, you could look back at from the end of Psycho and look at everything Norman did and say, this is because of this thing.
Yes.
You can work out how his personality has been working.
And you're very patiently explained there, right?
But I don't think you ever get anything like that here. It's just, well, that was the thing he did because he was crazy.
I think you touched upon it where you said Bruno isn't, he's not any specific pathology. He is crazy and therefore he can do anything that the plot needs him to do. I think that was a good way of...
It's a shame. I will give this, you know, masterpiece for the first half to what, half to a third of it, but...
Absolutely not
overall.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it is spoken as one of his masterpieces, one of his later masterpieces. Well, 51, I don't know if that's a later masterpiece or not, but...
Given that I've been saying both North by Northwest and Psycho build off this.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think they are both better films. So.
What have we talked about? Psycho, North by Northwest, The Birds, Rear Window. All of them were, all of them, Vertigo, well, maybe not Vertigo, actually. Vertigo's not, doesn't feel like a suspense film as a sort of psychodrama. All of the others work better to suspensify me. Okay, well, let's move on to our second Hitchcock, and probably our last for a little while. The film which I quoted and which led to many a high moment of me as a student, the 19... It actually predates Strangers on a Train by a few years. The 1948 potential masterpiece, Rope.
And yet, here we are, back in colour.
Back in colour. So, 3 years earlier, back in colour, and Farley Granger returning, or pre-turning, or however you might say it. And we also have James Stewart. And we have John Dahl. I don't think John Dahl has been one of our alumni before.
No, I don't think so.
Alongside Joan Chandler as Janet. I mean, the women here get pretty short shrift, I'm afraid. But Mrs. Wilson probably does better. This is one of them. There are gimmick films that Hitchcock likes doing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'll come back to that, but I'd like to say, first of all, we've got another Ribbon of Memes alumnus here.
Do you mean the writer?
Yes, because this is based on the play. I don't mean the writer of the screenplay.
The writer of the play,
or
who is?
The story by, but the writer of the original play is Patrick Hamilton, who also wrote Gaslight.
Both versions. Well, he didn't write both versions of Gaslight, but he wrote the play of which both Gaslight versions. He was. In fact, the play was 99p or something on Kindle, so I bought it to have a read of it. I think remarkably similar, actually, because I gathered it was quite different. But you know, a lot of the dialogue is straight from the play.
As I understand it, in the play, the two leads are explicitly homosexual, or rather as explicitly homosexual as you could be in 1929 when it came out.
Yes. Whereas here...
You could assume they are, you could assume they aren't. There's nothing specific to say. I think that's
well,
fair.
I read, and I think... So, what we have here is a setup loosely based, though Patrick Hamilton swears it wasn't, but it seems very odd, on the Leopold and Loeb murder.
Which we have previously mentioned, I believe.
We mentioned in our last Hitchcock, and I in fact indeed quoted from Clarence Darrow's moving and eloquent speech to get them to avoid the death penalty, which he successfully did. 8-hour closing speech he did. But his argument... briefly, the Leopold and Loeb murders were... Murder was two brainiacs. Were they Harvard scholars? I'm not sure, but...
University of Chicago.
University of Chicago, high-flying intellectuals who had rather taken Nietzsche's concept of the Superman to heart and decided that they could commit a murder just because they could. Turns out they weren't as clever as they thought they were, because they did exactly what Bruno was going to do to Guy and leave a set of prescription glasses with the body, the poor young 15-year-old, I think he was, that they murdered. They got him in the back of a car and beat him to death, basically. It was pretty unpleasant. But it turns out the particular type of glasses they left behind, only three or four people had them in the state, and they were pretty quickly tracked down and arrested. But they did avoid the death sentence thanks to Clarence Darrow's speech.
And just for calibration, that's in 1924, so... It got huge publicity. It was talked about as the crime of the century. It seems to me implausible that Patrick Hamilton wouldn't at least have known about it, even if he was consciously trying not to copy it. It would have been there in the back of his mind, because it was just everybody knew about it.
Well, the setup of this film is two clever by half students decide, based on their concept of the Nietzschean Superman, to murder. Because they can. So it seemed pretty... It, as you say, maybe. It must have been in his mind in some way. Anyway, doesn't matter. Because the Rope is a film... And the reason it is relevant to talk about the play is this is much like Birdman, that we spoke about earlier. One of those films which is all in real time, one long, huge take, 70, 80 minutes of it, or is it?
Well,
no, it isn't.
Yeah, it's a little trickier than that because there are two separate things going on here. Because on the one hand, you have the limitations of your film camera, and you can load
physically the amount of film that you can.
Yeah, you can load about 10 minutes into a film magazine. So you have to change shot in some way roughly every 10 minutes. But also, in the cinemas of the time, a reel was about 20 minutes. And quite often in those days, there would be a pause while the projectionist changed the reel if they didn't have a setup of multiple projectors and things. Mm-hmm. So you actually get two different sorts of thing going on here. You get, the magazine change every 10 minutes, which can be disguised with let us move into a static object and then move out again.
Yeah, moving something that fills the screen completely with black or something that isn't moving, as you say, and then, yeah.
And then the 22-minute ones, they would actually be a discontinuity of the watching experience, so there's less effort made to disguise it, and some of them are, I believe, actual cuts.
Well, yeah, so we do actually. Now, I have to say, watching the film, I didn't even notice the cut, and so it does bring to mind the question that, well, what was the point of it then? Because if I didn't even notice when there was a cut, and there's like three cuts in the film to close-ups of people usually standing out shouting something, but I didn't notice them. I had to go back and check, and then, oh yeah, it did cut to his face at that point.
I think the point is, does it serve the story to do this single shot thing, or is it a gimmick? Now, I think it's fair to say in Birdman we more or less came down on the side of gimmick.
I'm conflicted with Rogue, which we'll talk about later, but I do, I think there's part of it that adds a sense of, realism and tension to it. But then.
Well, particularly because a lot of what's going on here is the gradual, psychological disintegration of the two principals.
Yes. So briefly, the film starts...
Because we're not cutting away from them to say, oh, you know, it's half an hour later or whatever.
Exactly.
We're seeing it all as it goes.
And I think that was the idea, really, to increase... So the film, briefly, again, many spoilers abound, but it starts with the murder of a fellow student, literally him breathing his last as he collapses to the floor. And then they put him in a trunk, and then... one of the characters, Brandon, played by, who I've mentioned before, John Dahl, it kind of gets his kicks from displaying, making all the characters at the dinner party that'll soon arrive, basically have lunch, have dinner off the trunk. So he gets his kind of thrill of, oh, there's a body in there and they don't know. That's the tension, really. There's a trunk here. Everyone's close to it. We're constantly moving around it and by it. And I think that's the idea, that we're supposed to be getting more and more tense.
Well, as they are, that's the thing.
Yeah,
They are becoming increasingly aware that... Well, yeah, I think what Brandon is trying to do is deliberately... I would characterize him here as a thrill seeker more than anything else. It's not just enough for him to commit the perfect murder and get away with it.
Absolutely.
He is deliberately leaving a bit of the relevant rope around the place so that people will see it and say, oh, look, here's a bit of rope. He's deliberately saying, we will have the dinner party on this chest with the body in it, and so
exactly.
on.
Exactly. And he wants to, it's, again, as you say, it's not enough for him just to, he wants someone to tell him how clever he's been for having done it, and he wants to sort of, if no one else is going to do it, he's going to tell himself. So does that work as a, it does kind of work for me, and I fully accept for most people watching this film, it doesn't work. For me, somehow it does work. However, the bits where it doesn't work for me are the very obvious. The 10-minute takes that you said where we're into the... Quite often that is just not subtly done. It's just like, we're going to zoom right into this person's back for no particular reason.
Yeah. And then move on as if we'd done nothing special.
Yeah.
There was one, I can't remember whereabouts, but where they are opening the lid of the trunk and the camera is right next to it, and so everything goes black because the lid's right in front of it, and then they close the lid. But it is clearly at a different distance from the camera.
Yes, yes. So they're the bits that split, not the cuts away, because I didn't notice those quite often because I was interested in the story. But yeah, those bits where it's just like, well, why are you... this takes me out of the story, and for no reason, really, just for the sake of a gimmick. So I agree. Ultimately, whatever the point of it, it does come down to a gimmick, and you're less forgiving of it in a film than you would be in a play. I mean, you wouldn't have to do that in a play, but...
Yeah, but also, when you do something on a play, you know, you have a scenery flat that is unconvincing. Well, yeah, there's the limit to how convincing a scenery flat can be.
Exactly, yes, yeah, and you buy into
whereas
that.
In a film, we can stick in a background clip of whatever.
I'd certainly James Stewart was kind of unimpressed with this. Why are we filming it? So that still meant that the actor, and there's a lot of moving around and choreography, and because these are big chunky cameras of the day, what that basically meant was all the scenery had to be constantly moved around and rearranged as the cameras followed these people around. And I think for the actors, it was probably a more exasperating experience than watching it is.
It is said that Hitchcock was surprised and disappointed that the actors couldn't remember 10 minutes worth of lines, but this was said mostly by Hitchcock, and other people have claimed that he was simply lying about that.
Maybe I've read this, or maybe I just imagine it. A lot of the problems with the takes and things were probably more technical issues of the camera bonking into something or moving around. These are actors. A lot of them acts at the top of their game. And yes, maybe some of them were more film actors, but none of them were strangers to acting in plays. And, you know, they remember a lot more than 10 minutes at that point. It's probably all about the footing and where exactly they have to be.
Yeah, well, they had very precise choreography because they had to plan, you know, the actors are going to move from here to here this way, and therefore the camera is going to move around, and the other camera is going to move around, and the microphone is going to move around, and so on. So I suspect that made it a high-stress shoot in itself.
And there's no room for kind of improv or anything. Even in a stage play, you know, you can play with it a little bit. But here, there's just no room for anything other than doing exactly what you're told, which is what Hitchcock would love, I guess, because he likes his actors to do what he told them. But I can imagine as an actor, that's an exasperating experience.
Also, it does cheat a bit anyway, and here is a formal dinner, but it lasts 20 minutes.
Exactly, yeah, so it's all compressed and doesn't make a huge amount of sense. It's also very wordy, and...
it's a very talky thing. That sometimes that happens with a film of a play, and I think it would be... Thinking of the thing as we see it, which is basically the living room and then we move out into the hall and back a bit.
Mm.
But it's mostly that. And I could see staging it with basically a set that looks like that. And then, you know, we'll put the actors over here when they're welcoming people in through the front door and so on. You could build that all as one big stage.
Yes.
And if you had that, I think it might look quite similar. As you say, it's a very talky film. I think it's probably quite would you call it a talky play? I mean, it's certainly not an action film.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's all the psychodrama of, as you say, watching them get more and more nervous and disintegrating. And finally they invite Rupert along, who is, this is in the film now, but it happens in the play too, who is the professor who they both followed, and he sleuths it out that, you know, he works out what's happening, largely because Brandon is basically waving it in his face for most of the film.
And meanwhile, Philip, who is Farley Granger again,
yes,
he's just disintegrating.
Now, Farley Granger I like much more here because, as I said,
too.
In the last one, he's really good at the emotional acting. And what we're seeing is him basically getting more and more and more tense, pissed off with Brandon until he just basically melts down. And I like John Dahl here as the smug git of the film who just can't help himself but to show off. And so James, I generally like James Stewart. I do enjoy watching him, and I enjoy his kind of detective work here. But the problem for me with Rope is that you never really... He is supposed to be the inspiration for these two students. He's supposed to be the one who is... And in the play, he is much more unconventional and doesn't give a shit about normal society and reminds me a bit of the Inspector... Is it Inspector... Thick, I can't remember, in Gaslight, that kind of the first version of Gaslight, I can't remember, the larger guy who has horses, who really is just kind of unusual and different, but also a genius. But Stewart plays him here as an everyman, because James Stewart is an everyman, and so he's, there is a little talk of him saying, oh, think about murderers, you know, you could just kill someone in front of you. But it's not convincing that in any way he believes that. He, or would convince other people to believe it. He's doing it as a kind of a comedy skit.
Well, the way I read it from these performances, as distinct from the play, is that he would be throwing that out as a thought experiment to shock.
Yes.
And he is utterly horrified to discover that they actually took it seriously.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. That's what the film does. I just think it works better, having read through the play, of a guy who kind of almost believes that until it's tested, and then he realises, shit, no, I couldn't actually do that. That's awful, what you've actually done. And I feel it works better in the play than as a kind of... The reason it works better for me in the play is because you don't really believe these two very clever students would be inspired by Rupert to do that.
He's not a very inspiring man.
No, it's like a joke for him. And as you say, for shock value. But he'd never for one second ever expect anyone to do it. And the way it does work, I suppose, is the shock and horror of Rupert's character when he finds out what they've done. He does earn that because you feel he's a decent character. But in a way, it would have worked better for me if, I don't know. He's not unconventional enough. He's a bit too everyman.
I found it interesting. This is possibly just because, as we've talked about before, I read a lot of mystery stories. I got the feeling that Rupert thinks he is in a mystery story.
Yes, I absolutely agree, yes.
As opposed to a psychological story, which is what this is. Well, that was the thing, because it's not a mystery, because we see right there in the very first shot what happened.
Well, this is the emphasis... Sorry, I'm going to... You know, Hitchcock's thing was, you know, drama, I think it was drama, he said, was a bomb going off under a table. The suspense is, you know, there's a bomb under the table that's going to go off in 2 minutes, but the characters don't. And that's exactly what we got here. You know, there's a body in the trunk, and we know it the whole way through, and nobody else knows it in the room except...
Yeah, so the next step from that would be the suspense of, are they going to be caught? But then, of course, these are still the days of the production code, so of course they're going to be caught. So the tension that's left is, when will they be caught, and whose nerve is going to break first? Well, surprise, surprise, it's the extremely nervous guy.
I agree, yes, it's not...
It does undermine itself a bit simply because of the range of things that can be done within that form.
Yes, that's fair. Now, that said, when I watched this first, I was not aware of that. And so for me, I wasn't thinking, oh, the production code means they got to get caught. And so for me, it did work in that way.
Fair
as
enough.
A suspense. And as I've been talking, Strangers in it, where Strangers on a Train fails miserably to make me feel suspense. Rope does. And I wonder if it's because I like kind of talky play. You know, I like Sleuth, the play with, well, it filmed with Laurence Olivier and Michael Caine. I it's funny because I didn't really read mysteries or anything, but I like that kind of tension building up like that. So for me, I respond quite well to it, even though it's very talky and very kind of silly. And as you say, a 20-minute a dinner party. You know, we have the nice moment with the father of the David's father. Mr. Kentley, Cedric Hardwick, I think. He's the moral center of the film. You know, he's intelligent, but he's like, no, I'm not going to stand here while you, I don't want to listen to you talking about murder in this way. I respond well to that. So I quite like the things that they're discussing, even if James Stewart doesn't sell me. That's the problem, really. Cedric's supposed to be, I feel like, the moral center. And Rupert, James Stewart, is supposed to be the kind of the unconventional view that's like, oh, you just got such an old-fashioned view of black and white. But he doesn't quite sell me on that because James Stewart's so decent as a screen.
And also he realises by the end that he has been wrong all this time. And he's, you know,
yes.
You picture him throwing away his unconventionality props.
Yes, exactly. There's my green wig in a bit.
But yeah, as a result, none of the principles is particularly sympathetic, and that does hurt it with me.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You feel a bit more, like Brandon is particularly unsympathetic. You feel more sympathy for Philip, Farley Granger's character. For some reason, I very much accept the flaws. It's gimmicky, it's talky. For some reason, Rope really works for me, and I think partly everyone was so down on the film. Everyone said it's rubbish. Like Hitchcock, all the actors for the most part were like, oh, I hated it. What a rubbish film. And I feel that's unfair on the film. For me, for whatever reason, it works well. I enjoy the tension. I enjoy the talkiness of it. Maybe if I'd seen it as a play, I would have been absolutely blown away. But as it happens, I've seen it as a film. And I enjoy it very much. And it does work in the suspense for me. Is it a masterpiece? I think it's got too many flaws and problems to be a masterpiece.
I don't think I liked it as much as you did, but certainly I enjoyed it more than Strangers on a Train taken as a whole, less than the first half of Strangers on a Train.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I think I'm unusual in this respect, but I do think Rope has been perhaps unfairly dismissed as a gimmicky thing.
It does a better job of being a gimmick film than Birdman, certainly.
Yeah.
Because the gimmick does actually tie into what's going on.
Yes, Birdman doesn't need to do that. And even then, it does time jumps in Birdman, which makes you think, well, why are we, what's the point following this? I mean, obviously Birdman is way more technically accomplished, but that's, you know, that's because they didn't have any of the technical limitations of Hitchcock.
I would just like to make one last visit to Roger's Murder Corner. What one is that? Yeah, with killers of the unrepentant type, you know, they plan it out, they do it. It's quite usual if there is a second one, then they are effectively psychologically dominated by the first one. You see that with. Most serial killers act alone, but you get occasionally one with an assistant, and that's usually the way it works. So that's nicely observed. I did find myself thinking repeatedly, oh boy, that's got to be a really tightly sealed chest. certain things tend to relax at the moment of death.
Well, this is never talked about in these cozy murder films that, you know, people shit themselves and horrible things come out and it's just unpleasant. And, you know, that also, you know, that the thing is never twitching up and down as the corpse moves and gas is rearranging it. I mean, that would have been a nice moment if the corpse kind of stood up. as they are wont to do from time to time. Bodies actually sit up. They have to seal coffins much later, of course. But anyway, I took it as read. Maybe that's why I like this one so much, because it is a wholly unrealistic situation. It looks like a play, frankly. It doesn't really look like a real apartment. It kind of feels like one. I don't know why I respond to it. I think I'm going to have to put this down as a guilty pleasure because I'm very aware of all the kind of flaws of it. But I do think it's a bit unfairly.
There was one thing where the film unexpectedly came to my rescue because I started off thinking, oh boy, all these 40s men look awfully similar. And then the film helpfully puts them in different coloured suits. You know, in an anime series where everybody has the same face, but you give them different coloured hair so the audience can tell them apart.
Well, that's very handy, yes. Yeah, fair enough. Well, it's nice to hear you having trouble distinguishing from middle-aged white guys. That's because they all look the same. That's good.
And they, well, they are drinking the widow, so, you know, give them credit for taste. At least in the first scene, they're drinking. It's got that distinctive orange label, which you see in the very first scene, but not at the main body of the party.
So they're not going to give it to the guests.
They're keeping the good stuff for themselves.
Quite right, too. Well, I mean, this will be our... Is this our seventh Hitchcock?
Seventh.
I can't remember. Seventh. Are you one... So I started as quite a fan of Hitchcock from the beginning of these seven films that we watched, partially, in truth, because of Rope. I feel like that the... I've become less of a fan, unfortunately, partly watching a lot of them in succession. Interestingly, these two do not have Hitchcock blondes in either of them. All the others that they've featured prominently, and it gets a bit wearing. I'm less of a fan.
Earlier in his career, he couldn't get away with indulging himself as much, perhaps.
Yeah, it could be. But I still love Rope for some reason. I still love Rear Window. I still think Psycho's great.
And none of them to me is an untarnished masterpiece. I've enjoyed some of them. I had never actually seen a Hitchcock film before we started doing this.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
So I had heard about what a vile person he was in many respects. So you know. My feeling now is there are bits of really superb craftsmanship here, and I will praise that while still thinking he was a fairly vile person.
Yes, we are not replacing John Carpenter as our favourite director, I think, of Ribbon of Memes. I don't know, we might have done more Spielberg than Carpenter. We should put that right.
Well, next year we have an anniversary post.
Okay. All right, well, there we are. It only remains for me to say there is a murder I've got to do, Roger. I wonder if there's one you want doing. Maybe we could...
You know, oh, so many. So many.
Multiple crisscross.